This is the NCARB podcast, where you get an inside look at licensure, regulation, and the initiatives shaping the future of architectural practice. I'm your host, Andy McIntyre, Vice President of Marketing and Communications at NCARB. And this season, we're diving into Pathways to Practice, NCARB's multi-year effort to rethink how architects become licensed.
Architecture is the hardware to the software of life, right? It is fundamentally about that interaction, and it makes life easier if we have a built environment that works.
Across 8 episodes, we'll explore how licensure got to where it is today and where it needs to go next. We talk with architects, educators, regulators, and NCARB leaders about education, experience, and the exam, and why each of those pillars is evolving.
And that portion of school where you go from conceptual to real is also really challenging. It's not something you're really gently moved into. It's kind of like you're doing something that's flowy and crazy, and all of a sudden, wait, you actually have to make this work.
You'll hear how the NCARB competency standard was developed, how research is shaping future licensure models, and what a more flexible, competency-based approach could mean for candidates from a wide range of backgrounds.
So we've seen that in our data as the number of reciprocal licenses starts to decrease a little bit, but that number of individuals who are licensed holds steady.
We also tackle the big questions. Why does licensure look the way it does today? Where do candidates face the biggest barriers? And how can we expand access without lowering standards?
Not everybody fits into the same mold. And so having different pathways to licensure, I think, is really important.
Whether you're a licensure candidate, an educator, a firm leader, or a regulator, this season offers clarity, context, and transparency into one of the most important conversations facing the profession.
Does this requirement to complete all divisions of the exam place an unfair burden on any one group or other?
This is Pathways to Practice, only on the NCARB podcast. Please follow the link in the show notes, subscribe now, and join us as we explore the future of architectural licensure.
Hi, y'all, and welcome to another episode of She Builds Charrettes.
As a reminder, in these charrettes, we talk more about certain topics, make major announcements, conduct interviews. Basically, She Builds Charrettes is our playground for things outside of our typical format.
Right. So no need to worry, we're still doing our regular show. Today, we have a really interesting charrette headed your way. We are joined by Julia Pascuto, one of the authors of the study and article named Perceptions of Gender in Classrooms and Associated Expectations of Belonging. Y'all, this was an extremely interesting and illuminating read for us, and we cannot wait to get into it. But before we do, let's introduce Julia. Julia Pascuto is a licensed architect with over 12 years experience in Toronto, Montreal, Vancouver, and San Francisco, with a focus on thoughtful design of education, community, residential, and healing spaces.
She is driven by informing and improving the human experience with placemaking through a deeper unpacking and understanding of context, leading to the creation of more inclusive, resilient, and responsible design. She is inspired by the value of collaboration, diverse perspectives, and evolution through experience.
Julia is a design director that is fully integrated into the project design and delivery methods, concentrating on efficacy and relationship building.
Without further ado, welcome, Julia.
Thank you. So happy to be
welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, we're so excited to talk to you and about this article in particular. But first, how did you get into architecture and where do you work now? What's your role there?
That's a great question. I'm told that I wanted to be an architect basically my entire life. who knows? That's coming from my mom, but I was most passionate about math and art when I was a kid, and architecture is sort of a perfect fusion of those two interests.
Right.
And my mom also studied interior design when I was young, and I was fascinated with the model building, and the scale models are really captivating for kids. Almost dangerously alluring, like keep them away or else they might go into architecture. So just that's a warning to parents out there. And now I'm an architect working as a design director for LeMay, which is a design practice in Canada. And we also have a studio in New York all the way to Calgary. And it's around 500 people with roots in Montreal. Cool. And what I do now, I continue to be involved in research, but a majority of my time is in mixed use and residential, hoping to get back to more community and education spaces, because that's really what I'm very passionate about. But what's really great is you learn so much from working different typologies. And so what you learn from working in education and sort of community building can actually be applied to mixed use spaces. So yeah, it's been that's where I am right now.
Awesome.
That's exciting. So the article you put together was part of your work with the firm you're with now, right?
So it's actually come with me from back in the day, which was pre-pandemic, hard to believe, but yeah, I worked at a firm called Gould Evans, which is now multi-studio. And then when I moved back to Canada in the middle of the pandemic, for many reasons, border closure and all of that, I was luckily able to bring that the research with me. So both firms have a sort of research arm associated with it. So I was sort of able to fold it in and continue to be supported by the companies, and sort of they open it up and allow it to move with me. Nice. And yeah. And so, but I still have my major partner and collaborator is at Multistudio. And so we still work together regularly. We're texting last night. And so it's been a really cool way to collaborate. We've actually never met in person, but we've been working together for like five years on this.
That's crazy and wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of the article, could you give us, let's say, a Reader's Digest summary of this? Because it's pretty dense. I remember like really diving into it. But tell us about the summary of what it is, and how did the study come about? How did you become interested in this topic? How long did the study run for? All those things.
Absolutely. So sort of already dabbled into this, but in a former life, I was working in San Francisco for Multistudio, and we were working on an elementary school in the city. And it was a really great opportunity. The school district was really involved heavily, and they were trying to challenge the status quo by creating a school which was more of a hub for the community, while also evolving to provide spaces that were more flexible to respond to a new pedagogical approach in teaching and learning, universal design for learning. And so it was to be the first of its kind. And the experience was extremely collaborative. And so we had extensive feedback and collaboration with the educators, the administrators, facilities. So they were involved. The people that were going to be using and in those spaces were heavily involved. And that was critical for sort of how this came to be. So we were presenting a lab space for high school students. And from the stakeholders, we heard that the lab space had male dominant patterns. And their feedback was, how can we make a young girl feel like this space is for me? And so that was pretty jarring. Like the principal on the project was a woman. So we were both like, OK, so we've created this space that is not inclusive for everybody. And that's the intention for the school, is it's a space for each and every. And so clearly we were missing the mark. And so it really gave us pause, and we took it back, and we had an education arm, a research arm at Multistudio. And I was given the opportunity to push this further. And so out of it, it was like, oh, let's just start unpacking it. But it's hard to really establish how you unpack this question of like, what is a masculine pattern in a space? Where does it start? Is it who designed the space?
Right.
Is it who taught the designers for the space? It's like, who's feeling this way based on like their upbringing, their background? So it is. And very, very,
there's
very
a lot of variables.
And so,
yeah,
exactly. So we just wanted to start, like, we sort of honed in and sort of began to unpack it in a way that we could isolate some sort of findings out of it. And so I was connected with the lead researcher for Multistudio, Dr. Michael Ralph. And he's been the co-research lead since 2019. And he's a researcher by training. He's an award-winning educator as well. So it was the perfect collaboration. So I'm sort of the design side, and he is the research and education side. Cool. And so we started our project, Gender Inclusive Design Study. And it was really about gendered messaging in a design classroom, and to essentially to show its impact on students. So we sought to determine how classroom designs can have different gendered perceptions between those who use a space and those who work in the design industry. After several iterations, we released two studies, which we collected survey data from undergraduates and then employees at design firms reacting to masculine versus feminine design patterns in rendered classrooms. And the two groups exhibited strong but opposite correlations between their perceptions of femininity, sense of belonging, plus there were differences between the femininity scale itself. And we can unpack that more as we go. But these findings really showed the importance of closer examinations of masculinity and femininity as gender constructs and the need to further study how perceptions of designers differ from the perceptions of users as well.
Yeah, it was super interesting. I feel like, I mean, it sparked a long conversation even just between us and our perceptions of like you said, just how designers interpret things versus a user.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then all the little like nuance of like certain things throughout the research, like we were, it got us like questioning it, like, but like in a good way, like out of curiosity of just like, well, I wonder if this part got tested or how that got examined or like, had they considered this? And like, so like one, for example, was like, even just the term gender in the context of this study. So I'm wondering if maybe you can help define the word gender in the context of like your research and like if you could differentiate gender versus sex maybe, and like what are masculine versus feminine traits in the context of design, because that threw a whole loop for us too.
It was defined in the study also.
It's like, who's deciding that and how is that? And it's like culturally going to change. It's like completely varied. And so, you know, our study was focused on North America,
right?
From coast to coast or more. We had our focus groups were in universities in the U.S., Midwest, like all across. So it wasn't actually the extremes per se. And then our professionals were in United States and then in Canada, Toronto, Montreal. So we try to get a bit of a geographic range there so that it could be more of a broader study. But regarding sort of your question of how we're defining gender versus sex, so essentially users encounter and react to the built environment as it interacts with all the dimensions of who they are, with different people having potentially contrasting experiences depending on the identities that they bring into the space. So gender represents one such identity. Gender is distinct from sex. And in our work, we use gender to reinforce the socio-cultural identities, roles, behaviors, and expressions of women, men, and gender non-binary people, which must be understood in sort of the historical and cultural context. So a user's gender may be more or less salient to them at any given moment, which could increase or decrease its influence on their experience in an interior environment. The environment plays an active role in this interaction with the potential to embody and express gendered patterns introduced during design. So regarding sort of masculinity and femininity, we operationalize femininity as the complex social understanding of traits and ways of being broadly coded to being or enacting womanhood. So femininity as a construct is extensive and variable across time, space, and culture. But within the study, we do not speak to comprehensively define femininity, but to sample it with the following terms. So we use female, feminine, nurturing, inspiring, and motivating. And so essentially the questions like, is this space motivating to you? They were strongly correlated to femininity. There's this really great tool by Building Without Bias. And essentially, you can like put in a word and it will tell you which way a word scales, masculine or feminine. And so we tested that within that system. And we also tested it with our colleagues. So we did like three iterations of words, especially when we translated this into French. Sex means something completely different. It's much more like male versus female. It's much more like carnal and animalistic. As it translates. So we had to go through this extensive like translation of words to make sure that we weren't like using a completely different meaning or undertone of these words. And then so within the terms of the femininity scale, which was intended just to sample femininity and not measure it comprehensively. Femininity is not limited to women and gender non-binary people, and men can enact expressions of femininity as well. So that's important to clarify. It's more about sort of how one connects to those parts of their gender messaging.
Mm-hmm.
And so we designed the four spaces initially to differentiate from each other. And so these were based on informal preliminary studies, which included those workshops, focus groups, early studies, and review tools of our own intuitions, like gender in a classroom. And that's really, a lot of it was just like intuition, because it's not clear.
Yeah.
But just from our research, you know, if you imagine a quick web search of boys' room versus girls' room,
right,
something different is going to come up. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, how do we understand that and unpack it? And so you'll notice that there are distinctions between these spaces.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If you imagine maybe like a sterile, colorless lab space that maybe has sharp edges, you might pick up on masculine cues.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Every individual is probably going to experience it differently, but that's what we were able to find in our lab space that was quite sterile. Masculinity was how people reacted to that space. And so contrarily, if you have spaces with more feminine cues, they might be softer. They may have softer materials, more acoustic absorption, warmer lighting, curves are rounded so that it's a quieter space. Sounds aren't reflecting as much. And you're able to sort of pick up on that intuitively. And so that's what we use, sort of all those different elements to create those types of spaces. So regarding sort of the four spaces that we used to create a bit of a range from masculine to most feminine,
mm-hmm.
Space one was intended to strongly evoke masculinity with the absence of femininity, included design decisions like the use of a neutral black and white color palette overlaid with angular and linear space features. Space two was much more wood furniture, earth tones palette. Space three started to incorporate more heavily feminine elements, mm-hmm. like color in the walls, additional seating to distinctly curvilinear tables. Mm-hmm. And then finally, space four was intended to intentionally emphasize femininity and minimize masculinity with soft colors, additional windows and light for more visibility,
mm-hmm.
The exchange of a secondary chalkboard and more vision panels. I mean, even just we tried to standardize the spaces so it was the same sort of aspect ratio. The windows were consistent, the same amount of nature.
Mm-hmm.
The layout was the same generally, but it's all about sort of creating. I mean, people, if you have more enclosure within the space, it may feel more confined. That can have implications. If there's people seeing in, mm-hmm. people may feel more uncomfortable or more comfortable, because visibility is really important. And so we tried to keep it as sort of standard across the four spaces, with just making these sort of subtle changes so that you could start to track what those changes were and how it may impact the respondents' feeling within those spaces.
Yeah. Oh, it's so fascinating. And I think too, I really liked the piece too of like, when you were talking about the masculine and feminine in the study, and even just now too, just the different describing words, like you were saying, of what you're trying to get from it and kind of how everyone can embody those two different things in different ways. And so just, yeah, like inspiring, motivating versus like dominant, I think was the masculine mm-hmm. word, correct?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I found that really interesting, as like an interesting kind of framework to think about how we look at a space and how that might be more feminine or masculine. Because I think, yeah, inherently we don't necessarily think about it that way, but I think it is a really good way to describe and kind of create more of that framework and separating it from sex, essentially. And just in terms of like how that can be embodied.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so in the study too, there were three study questions that you were trying to, that were sort of like the purpose of the study, right? That you were trying to answer. Can you elaborate a little bit on those?
So we were trying to establish a better understanding of the sense of belonging for a spectrum of gender identities, which was really the foundation of the questions. Should I say the questions? I can read them out. But essentially, how do perceptions of gender and sense of belonging differ between classroom designs intended to express more or less femininity and masculinity? Is there a correlation between perceptions of gender in space design and sense of belonging, either overall or in specific gender subgroups? And then finally, are there differences in the perception of these gender constructs between those who use and design the space, those students versus the design professionals? So we were trying to unpack how spaces like classrooms, which are so critical for the development of young people, how they can emit or project a certain gendered messaging, which may make students feel more or less welcome than they should be. I mean, they should all feel welcome, and that's the whole point of a classroom. So this could have negative repercussions for a student's desire to be in that classroom if they don't feel that sense of belonging. And so if we can unpack what these qualities are, perhaps then it can be better at creating the space that everyone has a sense of belonging in. That's a big part of universal design for learning. You know, some students thrive in loud environments. Some students are really great in that chaos because that's a reflection of their household.
Sure.
So like a silent, sterile classroom isn't necessarily good for every student. Mm-hmm. And the expectations that everyone should be quiet and submissive, that may be creating an excellent environment for one student, but it's not going to work for everyone. So sort of what part of what came out of this, like we need flexibility in these spaces. We need agility, and we need spaces where each and every student can feel that they are safe and they belong. And so that sort of responded to that importance of sense of belonging within these spaces. We were also trying to measure the associations between femininity, masculinity, and belonging scales. Belonging is a really well-studied and understood tool for studies as such as this. And so it helped sort of create that guideline for our outcomes. A theoretical aim of the study was to create a method of measurement that did not assume femininity and masculinity were opposites by default. So our results showed that in both populations, the two scales did indeed not exhibit a negative correlation for individuals. The third research goal was to examine the relationship between gender populations and an expected sense of belongingness between two distinct population users, so the undergraduates and the design professionals. And the key finding from these two studies used together was to address the goal that there was a disparity in the behavior of the femininity scale between undergraduates and design professionals.
Mm-hmm. That's a lot. You are doing so much with this research and unpacking so many different things. I'm wondering, out of all of that, what most surprised you of the study and of what you learned or found out?
It was really interesting. What most surprised me from the study, not being a researcher, just something interesting, was that our sample respondents were comprised mostly of people that identified as women. 71% used the she pronoun, which is consistent with known documented patterns of gender bias in willingness to participate in research. So it's just like, fun fact, women are generally more likely to participate in studies. Mm. That's not even what we're looking at, but that was just really interesting. Like, why?
That is funny.
We're just like, sure, we've got all this extra time. Let's just, you know, do the groceries.
And why not help you job
and we're gonna get, right. Yeah.
That's hilarious.
Does that speak of our nature of helping out? Like, let me contribute to the study.
Yeah. Or you never included me in all the other medical research trials. So I'm gonna volunteer myself so I can be considered in this world that is built for us. You know, we do make up half the population.
Yes.
A whole other wormhole that we shall table for another day. Hey, I hear that they're considering using a female body for crash test dummies. So
finally,
they should, because that's a thing.
Yeah, that's a whole thing.
Yeah. Jeez.
Yeah. I'm glad they're considering it.
Very generous.
How considerate of them.
Yeah.
Well, I'm most surprised by your response. Actually, I never, out of all the things I thought you would have been surprised by.
There's more.
That was just surprised like, me.
Yes.
I'm sure that everything you learned was.
But essentially, regarding the research more specifically, we identified two potentially interesting individual findings from the undergraduate study sample that diverge. The first was a single, particularly large difference in the perception of femininity in space 3 by those who identified as women undergraduates. This finding may have some potential theoretical implications, such as perhaps showing that spaces with stronger representations of femininity and masculinity together elicit greater differences in perceptions among users of different gender identities compared to the other spaces. The second was that we noticed a suggestive trend in how gender non-binary perceived the more masculine space, which is space one. There was a negative correlation between the perceived masculinity and the sense of belonging. So one could interpret this to mean that the perceived masculine quality of the space did not create a sense of inclusiveness for gender non-binary students.
Yeah.
So that's super interesting. Mm-hmm. And we also observed strongly opposing behavior of femininity scale between the two samples in association with their expectations of belonging. So this also could be interpreted that when spaces were perceived to be feminine in nature, that people who identified as women did not feel a sense of belonging in those spaces. So this is something that was early on, but I found it particularly interesting, and it's something that will need to be explored more.
Yeah.
So it's like, this space is perceived feminine as being feminine, and I don't feel like I belong there.
Yeah. It is interesting. We've had, like, I think about sometimes like these women organizations, and how sometimes like the women in architecture or what have you, like all these different groups specifically with the intention to do just like what you're saying with these spaces, by we're hoping that having these organizations or groups for women, that it'll bring more women in to kind of create this safe space, a space where they belong, so that we can talk about issues in the industry or profession, or even they have those organizations outside of architecture. Sometimes it works. Sometimes the women are like, yes, this is my tribe. I want to go and I want to, you know, like have these moments. And some women are like, why would I need to do that? I actually don't want to pigeonhole myself in these spaces. And it's interesting.
Yeah, or they don't feel super welcome there, or that kind of, you know, like it just,
And it is interesting. I mean, it ties closely to like the intention of a design space versus the actual practice and use of it.
Right.
Like part of what we observed in sort of the final and maybe even most shocking element was that the femininity scale for the undergraduate samples loaded poorly to the scale with the professionals. Mm-hmm. So essentially the undergraduates had a different understanding of what it meant to be a feminine space than the professionals.
Yeah.
So we need to understand and unpack that, because if there's a difference between the perceptions of how these spaces are interpreted by users, aka students, and the designers, aka the ones that are creating the space, then there's a disconnect, and that's huge. And why is that happening?
Yeah. That's hitting on to like something that we touched on while we were discussing the article as well, because like we notice it just with our podcast in terms of like as we've developed it, like it's interesting how different groups of people receive our show. Like whether it's like the younger students that they're like, yes, I was looking for this. I understand what you're going for. I get it. I want more of it. Older generations are like, is this going to be a short series just talking about women in your podcast? Or is it like, do we really need to talk about it? Like, what's the importance of telling these stories? So like there's that aspect. And then as we developed our show, it's interesting how it got us questioning things in terms of like our education, who teaches us, like these, like, you know, when we read history, it's all like this male-centric design and what gets taught and how we study it. And I guess like it was so impactful for us, and the way that you describe your research, it makes us wonder if you had a similar experience. If like, is this something that you realized in your study of like how we were taught design in school? And then have you started to look at your design work differently because of that, especially with the work that you're doing now?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, like you idealize like Mies van der Rohe, Le Corbusier, like we all like these architects have something in common. Right?
Right.
And it's like it's pretty sterile. It's pretty for a certain even economic bracket typically. I mean, they did have a range, but it is really interesting how there is an absence of the population and a lot of what our teachings were. A lot of our professors or my professors were also men, although that is getting better, I will admit. I mean, I think we're making leaps, but it was certainly eye-opening. And maybe perhaps it's less a change in design work and more so a desire to embed opportunities for more feedback and collaboration. I think, you know, where do we begin to start to address this inequity in the spaces and then the teaching and sort of continuing to backlog from there? Even technology, it could very much be biased as well. So architecture has long time been a male dominated white men profession. And so the socialization in the profession that reproduces as a male as normal paradigm could explain the variations in perception of femininity within the spaces. I mean, as designers, you know, you spend so much time being fully immersed in sort of the architecture culture that you see yourself in it. And maybe you lose track of what a typical, like, here I am wearing black. you know, being happy that I like stayed up all night, you know, that's sort of like the architecture culture that you sort of absorb and embody, and you start to talk differently. So, I mean, I think that there's a way that designers could lose track of sort of what it is to be like a normative human being in the world. And exactly. And so perhaps part of that is sort of a recalibration and a reconnection with who the users of the space are. But what we did extract out of this study was, you know, there's a couple of ways we can start to tackle this and make moves in the right direction. So first of all, start from being in the position of not being antagonistic. And then approaches that we can try to apply to design work begin with, one, understanding, like, what role does our profession play, male-dominated teachings, et cetera. So just understand that that exists. Understand who our iconic design influences are. Just, like, be aware. And then perception of the acoustic quality of the space. If it's a really loud space, who's being heard? What are the voices that are being drowned out? And sort of being aware of sort of how one might feel within those spaces. Two, construct clarity. So you need to know why it matters and understand the language that shapes thought. So why is it important that people are not included or feeling included in these spaces? And how can we raise those voices and give them a sense of belonging within the spaces? And you sort of just got to get it in that way. Number three is engagement. So who's at the table? Recognize who is contributing, who is not contributing, and who is using that space and who doesn't have a voice. So I think it's critical. I mean, even a hospital that I worked on many years ago. Now, I was in that hospital years later as a patient, and I was talking to the nurses. I was like,
what do you think?
How do you like the... And they're like, well... And I'm like, oh, no.
Yeah.
Okay, we missed the mark. I'm like, they're like, it looks great. I'm like, okay, but you're in this like 12 hours a day. Like, we should have been talking with you. You know, the hand washing stations aren't in the right spot, or sort of little things like the functionality and the day-to-day use of these spaces. We need to have not just like the head of surgery at the table, because they're maybe not aware of what the day-to-day long shifts are going to need. And then richness of so I guess keep on having those conversations. But richness of representation, not removal. So include, and I know it's like in our designer's nature to sort of like keep things like neutral, white background, blah, blah, blah. But maybe it's about more like if you can see an aspect of yourself within a space, masculine, feminine, the whole spectrum, then maybe that's the right approach, because then there's more inclusiveness and there's something, an attribute that can be perceived to be welcoming to more of the user group. And then five, design review, allow that feed loop to continue to happen. So it should go without saying that should be like, we're just unpacking like one layer of a very big onion, but what we're trying to do is sort of focus on one small layer of that complexity of belonging. And it doesn't even begin to peel back the complexity of like creed, ethnic origin, place of origin, race, color, ancestry, citizenship, neurodiversity, sexual orientation. I mean, like, this is not even like chipping at the surface of like the complexity of what it is to be a human in this world. Mm-hmm. But if we can try to create learning environments that are designed to consider sort of the farthest reaches of the spectrum rather than just the mean or the middle of the line, then in theory, you should be able to capture everyone.
That's so interesting. The way you were describing how like architects like to keep things kind of neutral. And I think just sort of going back to like who we were taught about in school and like what we were taught was good design, right? Is like a very blank slate kind of an idea. Mm-hmm. And I could see that like maybe the argument is like, oh, well, if we leave it a blank slate, then people can kind of like put what they want onto it. But to your point of like, maybe we need more for people to feel like they have the opportunity or like for them to feel welcome in the space. Whereas like if they don't see themselves at all, if it's too much of a blank slate, then it's like there's nothing there to work off of. Right. And that kind of thing. And so it almost feels less welcoming rather than like the intention of it being like you can make it what you want, you know, and that kind of thing. I found that part super interesting. Just the dichotomy between the undergraduates and the architects, because I do think a lot of times we have this idea of like what we've been taught is good design. Like that was a conversation we had too about the four spaces, and like I think Nurjiti was like, to me that space like number one is just like that's good design, and like and that's what we've been taught. Right.
That's like what we did. And we're like and they're like no, and you're like oh okay. But
I also felt like I was like, I can see why a user might think that feels sterile, though, like even though I see the design piece of it and why that is appealing as a designer and like the simplicity and all of that. But I also can see that users would be like, oh, that feels like sterile and not super welcoming and whatnot. So that it's just that interesting shift of our brains or like how we perceive things.
Absolutely.
But I think that brings up the importance of bringing in the user and the importance of participatory design. So when I was reading the study, that's what struck me the most, like the stark differences between the designers and even how I saw the space. Like you just mentioned, I thought number one was right, you know, and like, and then I started to consider, well, you know, I haven't talked to the users a lot in the design work that I do. I wonder how it would be so very different if I had the opportunity to talk with the users to get more of their input, not just this one client that I'm talking to, but more of the community. And I started to wonder if you have had the opportunity since your research of including more of the participants of the designs that you're doing in your work.
There, I mean, a lot of it is budget. You know, and so if you're not putting the time in to have that more participatory design, then, I mean, it is an upfront investment. So it is critical that clients and users are aware of the significant impact their collaboration will have on a project. Mm-hmm. And as always, there's the budget, but it is the, like the age old adage of like measure twice, cut once. So it's like collaborate a dozen times, build once, and instead of like renovating and like making editing later, it's very important to be invested in the stakeholder experience. And hopefully this becomes the norm, even in private projects. Like there's no doubt there'd be a benefit from the upfront investment for having more people feel included and considered in the space. But just to be very honest, you have to have a client that is very interested in whose headache is this? That's actually what our the head sort of director at Multi Studio, when we were tackling this question of sort of gender classrooms, he was like, whose headache is this? And who's going to want to invest in this? It's like, you can find like STEM universities, STEM colleges, if they want to increase their undergraduate applicants by making the space feel more included, then that's interesting for them and they'll invest in it. And so you have to sort of look at this from the wallet's perspective. And if they're going to get their ROI from being invested and including more people, then they're going to do it. But if they're not, it's not necessarily, unless it's mandated, it's not necessarily going to happen. So it's more likely to happen in like public projects where that's very important and it's mandated that you have inclusivity and sort of the stakeholder engagement as embedded in the process.
Yeah.
That's a really good point.
It is. So many things.
We're on the wrong side of this. If we could be the clients.
Yeah.
Oh, I
Let me work on that.
Yeah. Right? Okay. So the article was published earlier this year. How has the reception and feedback been? Like, have you received any negative feedback too? And how have you dealt with that?
Really, other than the author team being just glad to have it done and out the door, it's been pretty quiet. We've had a light interest from scholars and journalists, nothing substantive, no negative feedback that we're aware of so far, but like ears are open. Do you guys have anything to throw at me? Like,
oh, no.
No.
No, we were just curious.
Yeah.
Yeah. So far, so good. But I think any feedback would be good because it keeps the dialogue going. And if it challenges the study, then like we're all for it. I think it's just important to have the conversations.
Yes.
Because we're not necessarily doing this the right way, but we would love to have like more feedback to understand like a better way to do this. It's just not a lot of people have been asking this question,
right?
Which is sort of shocking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's hard too when you're the first, right? So you're sort of, you're doing what you think works, but like that eventually there might be like a different way of looking at it or studying it, different aspects and that kind of thing. But it's like good, you know, you got to start the conversation, right? And that kind of thing. And I think it's such an interesting topic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because what we liked about the article is like we wanted more. Like we wanted like to see how like it could further develop. Like one of the questions we had is like, were they able to research on children? Or maybe if like if that's like the next iteration of the study where you'll ask kids how they perceive a space, and then you got to explain to them masculine and feminine. I don't know. And then like, I don't know. So with what you're doing, is there something in the pipeline? Like personally, maybe if that sparked any other future interests based on your findings, what's next?
Yeah. Wanted to study because of it.
Yeah.
I mean, we've had some interesting conversations with other researchers, couple at McGill and all over, but we were looking actually into eye tracking software, which might even allow you to be more accurately targeting attributes of the space, which may trigger a certain reaction.
Sure.
Because I mean, you see a classroom and it's like, what in this space is making you have that feedback?
Right.
And so that's something we're looking in, but it's an investment.
Yeah.
It would be great to survey younger students. We just have to be careful with the criteria of approvals to do so, because like there's the IRB, like just to do what we did was like, you had to go through all the approvals, the submission, you had to like get a college professor to sign off on it. And then they had to like run it. And then it's just crazy to think like, no wonder research is so slow. Yeah. Like it's so much just to get like this, just to get here. But there's a lot that we want to go. I mean, we want to, even you could have like AI generated spaces. Mm-hmm. Like AI wasn't even a thing when we started. I mean, it was like in someone's garage, I'm sure, but now it's like it's here and we could use it to have like iterations. Could we have like AI regenerating rooms on the spot based on the eye tracking software feedback? Like, could you imagine? And like within like a short amount of time, you have like a space that is for you.
That's
that'd be crazy.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah,
that's interesting.
We just removed architect.
Oh, gosh.
Well, project manage, right?
Yeah.
But then what about the participatory design part aspect? Unless AI can figure that out.
And the experience AI is taking into it.
And then it's all about the
experience. Like you'll never, you'll never be able to replace like that, the lived experience, I hope.
True. That's our hope. At least that's what we keep telling ourselves to make us feel better.
Exactly. Any last thoughts, guys, or like things that we wanted to touch on?
No, but I really think there's the work that you've done is really important because it's brought on all these new things to consider that hasn't been considered before. And we talk on our show about participatory design or like community driven design. And it's always about the end user and how they use this space. But bringing in elements of like belonging and how they feel welcomed in a space, I think is something that we might have had the intention to do with what we do, but it hasn't been put in a way or formed in the way that your that this paper illustrates it, or like of what. And I think that was a big like eye opening thing, that it's like it makes you question everything. Like even when you're in school, then you try to do a project and you're like, wait, but did I consider all these things? And then it's I don't know. I think we had like a design existential like reflection moment after like reading it. Like we were like, whoa, now I'll look at all my design projects differently moving forward.
Like I for sure had that moment as well. Like I was put on an elementary school and I was like, ugh, kids, they're like messy and like germs. Things need to be like low and colorful. Ugh. And then I started doing it and I was like, oh my goodness, this is so much more important than all the other work I've done like ever.
Right.
Creating spaces where an autistic child can thrive.
Yeah.
Creating spaces where within that same classroom, you can have someone that needs more of a sensory experience. Mm-hmm. Like having these spaces that make such a strong impact for young people.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if it's colorful. That's great. I mean, I just learned a whole lot more and like this was born out of it. And eventually I'll get back to the sterile stuff sometimes. But I mean, this was just so much more. It ignited such a passion in me that I had no idea that I had.
That's
like
great.
The educational spaces and community spaces, like having everyone come together and having everyone's voices heard. That was the most rewarding part of all of this, like collaborating with the administrators, the teachers. Like it was just a wonderful thing to hear how passionate they were about creating spaces for each and every child.
Great.
Really cool.
I feel the same way that, well, obviously not at your level because I did not do all the things you did, but I feel the same way that as I was reading the study and even in this conversation, it's changed the way I look at design, the questions that I'm asking myself about the work that we do. Are people able to access the study? Can we put a link to it on our show notes?
We can put a link to it through the Journal of Interior Design.
Okay.
And then you can like click it. I think you have to like pay to download it, but we can't.
It's okay. Yeah. It's okay. Worth okay. it. Designers, well, you gotta get it.
Yeah. Honestly.
Just especially
get it here.
Our like what's it called? Our K-12 designers. I know that we have a couple of listeners that do K-12 and that do hospitals. Yeah. They could have your firms pay for it or something. Because it's worth it.
Yeah, right. Expense that. Yeah. I don't even think it's much. It's more just the formality of like supporting research.
Exactly.
And which then, is super important.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. It's great.
But I'm sure like after this conversation, I hope it sparks people to want to go read and learn more about this. Mm-hmm.
Because it's important stuff.
All right. Listeners, we'll do that. Go to our show notes.
Yes.
All right. Well, this has been a really great conversation. But we like to end with one question. In our regular episodes, we pick a caryatid or a woman who's working today holding up the profession. So, Julia, who is a caryatid whose work you're admiring right now?
There's a pair in Toronto at KPMB, Shirley Bloomberg and Mariana McKenna. They're inspirations. They founded the practice with two male counterparts over 35 years ago, which was pretty groundbreaking.
Yeah.
And they're it's pretty unprecedented to have two female founding principals and they do beautiful work and they lead a great team. But I do wonder sort of what the sacrifices were made along the way to get there.
Yeah.
So I can't say I want to necessarily be them because I imagine they probably had to make a lot of sacrifice.
Right.
So it is, I hope to find a balance and I'm able to sort of apply what I've learned from research into environments and have a positive impact, but be a leader and be a role model.
Yeah.
Just like them.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Please share the links to their firm so we could share that on the show notes too.
They could be future caryatids.
Can't wait to learn more about them.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Sounds cool.
There is Madame Architect.
Right.
Have you heard?
Yep.
Okay. So Julia Gamolina, we went to Cornell together. Oh. And so she's like the editor, creator of that publication. And she recently interviewed them both. So it's sort of a very small world.
Oh, okay. Okay. I knew the name sounded familiar. And okay.
We'll include links to that as well.
Yeah. It's like it is a small world, the architecture world.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you all for listening. This was a really fun charrette. I hope all of you out there listening enjoyed it too.
Please let us know what topics you'd like us to have Charette's on, and you might hear a future episode based on your suggestion. Again, thank you.
She Builds Podcast is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network, and Gable Media is all about building a better world. If this sounds right up your alley, which it should, listen and subscribe to all the shows at GableMedia.com. That's GABLmedia.com.
All right. So, Julia, we want to thank you for coming on to our show, spending your Saturday talking to us. And listeners, we want to know what you thought of our show and of our discussion. We really value your input and feedback. So tell your friends, your researchers, your nurses and students that you're masculine and feminine and non-gender binary. Tell them about our show and tell them to give us 5 stars on iTunes and Spotify and tell them to write us a review.
You can email us your thoughts at shebuildspodcast@gmail.com. Leave a comment on our website, shebuildspodcast.com, or follow us on Instagram and Facebook at shebuildspodcast and on X at shebuildspod.
Until then,
bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey there, architecture enthusiast. Nikita Reed here, inviting you on an incredible journey through time and space with my podcast, Tangible Remnants. Historic preservation and sustainability? Let's go ahead right now and debunk the myth that they are opposites. In fact, they are two sides of the same coin, shaping our collective future.
In a work environment, it has been challenging because I've had to probably do more than double just to make sure that I quote unquote fit in. But the environments that have allowed me to do me on the front end, I've been extremely successful.
You look at all these PhDs, they've built that on the backs of our elders.
Absolutely.
What they consider themselves to be experts at is what they've worked with us to achieve.
I know we have to. We have to prioritize people before products and before place.
Join me as we unravel the stories of historic buildings shaped by the people of a specific era and often influenced by race and gender. These tangible remnants are windows into our past and guideposts for the future. Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe now to Tangible Remnants. Let's explore the interconnectedness of architecture, preservation, sustainability, race, and gender.